The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting, presented by Nance Geese. Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm your host, Scott McNally. And with me, of course, as always, is Jordan Peters, Dr. Scott Stevenson. Jordan, how is it going today, man?
Very well, thank you. Finally over being unwell and, yeah, back in the swing of everything, which is pretty nice.
Nice. So while you were sick, had that affected your ability to eat, or were you still getting in all the calories you've always eaten?
No, I could still eat. It was fine. I just I wasn't able to train for that first week, and then the second week I could only kind of fluff around.
Okay.
But, which was a bit shit.
You do a lot of squeezing during that period, Jordan?
I wasn't really wheezing per se, but
no, squeezing, squeezing in the gym.
Oh, squeezing! yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, right on.
I did a few muscle rounds on some things, but then even they're pretty hard to breathe on those last sets.
Yeah.
So they fucked me up as well. So it was pretty much just stretch and squeeze stuff.
I bet. Scott, how you doing, man?
I'm good. I was actually thinking we have to change the title of the show to Muscle Minds and Maladies. we're always talking about how sick we got. I don't know what I ate. It was nothing out of the ordinary. The meal that seemed like it triggered it was a dozen eggs with some coconut oil. And I got a GI bug of some sort. And I was just like, it was like Drano. It was like I swallowed a can of Drano.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Just, you know how that, like, oh, man, I got to go to the bathroom and you get nauseated?
Oh, yeah.
So you're like, okay, I need to get out of here, you know, get to the toilet. And that's how it was for like almost like 2-3 days.
Jeez. I wonder what that could have been.
I really looked around. I tried to figure it. I just can guess it was the eggs.
Hmm.
And you know, the interesting thing with eggs, because Jordan and I talked about this, I think this was when you were in Columbus, right, Jordan? And you picked up some eggs, and in, you know, a lot of countries, in UK, and I think throughout the EU even, you don't have to refrigerate eggs because, you know, they have a natural antimicrobial barrier in the shell, et cetera. And, you know, so, you know, people worry about salmonella and various other bugs getting in there. But as long as the eggs aren't cracked, you're good to go. But in the States, we clean them off. And I think we even bleach them sometimes, you know, if they're not supposed to be brown.
Hmm.
And then that destroys that protective barrier.
Okay.
And then we have to refrigerate them. And that's why we have to refrigerate eggs in the States.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I think if I remember when I was a foreign exchange student in Germany. I think the first time I went over there, I bought some eggs. You know, I had like a little itty bitty spot in the dorm fridge.
Yeah.
And I put my eggs. I like took up, you know, a third of my space with eggs, and they're like, of course this isn't germ, but they're like, why are you refrigerating your eggs?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, because they'll go bad. Like, no, they won't. Why would you think that? I'm like, well, that's what we do in the States.
Wow.
Yeah, but anyway, that's sort of the reason. So the eggs that I ate weren't cracked. They weren't, I probably would have noticed. I mean, sometimes, you know, you get a cracked egg and it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Plus I cooked them fully. So anyway, don't know.
Weird.
But yeah, it was weird.
You know, they have that shelf-stable milk, too, where you could buy milk in a box in Europe. Do you guys have that, Jordan?
Yep.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, we have it here, but it's never caught on. I mean, I've seen it in the stores, but for the most part, people just don't buy it. From what I understand, I think they process it at just a higher temperature than the milk here. And you can keep that on the shelf versus, I mean, until you open it, right? Once you open it, then it has to be put in the fridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It's in a little square box.
Yeah. You know, speaking of groceries, I got to tell them about the travesty, Scott, that's going on down in Florida right now.
Yeah.
I shot a picture. I was at this cool grocery store the other day. VJ and I were talking about Westbourne Market on Bodybuilding Nerds. And lo and behold, I happened to be in downtown Plymouth, and they built this new Westbourne Market, which is kind of like a little boutique grocery store. This little town, a beautiful, cute little town with a little town center. They had this old post office. It was a historical site. They recently, in the last few years, closed it down to move facilities to, I guess, a more modern location. Well, they kept the building intact, and they renovated it and converted it into this cool, new Westbourne Market boutique grocery store. And I shot Scott a picture of their illustrious variety of sorbet, including a brand I had never seen before. They had blood orange and peach, all sorts of stuff. But
right now, yeah, peach sangria, as a matter of fact.
That sounds good. So I didn't buy it because I'm dieting, and I knew that if I were to buy that, I would have begun eating it even without a spoon, like just after I left. So I figured I'd leave it there. They'll hold on to it. When I'm ready, I will come back. But Scott, you told me that there is, what did you call it? It was a sorbet deficiency. It's what is it? There's just a shortage down there right now in Florida.
There is. I mean, this isn't fake news. If you read about this, maybe this is being suppressed by the powers that be, but, this happened the last two times I went grocery shopping. So, you know, I sort of make my way around like most people do. You kind of follow your normal route, and I saved the sorbet, in the quote unquote novelties section for last, so that I can make sure, you know, I don't do anything sacrilegious to the sorbet and let it thaw out or anything like that. So it's the last loaded in my cart and the first thing in the freezer when I get home. And I go to the sorbet section and I open up the door in the freezer and I just was flabbergasted. Literally there was,
what did you see?
I saw no sorbet. that was the issue. It was like my mind went blank. And so I looked around, I closed the door, opened the next one, thought maybe they'd moved it.
Yeah.
I looked back in the original spot, and then I saw that there seemed to be, sometimes a sorbet kind of gets, you know, packed in the back. So I looked in the back and, you know, kind of moved some around to see if there's someone that had been hidden back in there. Yeah. There's nothing. I closed the door again. I look up and down the aisle. I'm thinking, well, maybe they've just put an entire section called sorbet. You know, I'm thinking optimistically here.
They're listening to Muscle Minds, and yeah, the sorbet's getting more popular. Right. Sure, yeah.
I guess. And there was nothing. So it happened again the next time I go grocery, a different grocery store too, a different Publix. And I'm thinking, well, maybe they just ran out. Because there are times when I really think I might be the only one eating the sorbet, because, you know, you kind of make a bit of a mental map as to what it looks like when you were there.
Right,
and
right.
Back in, it's like, you know, the shelf looks just like the last time I saw it. I eat these fat-free Fig Newtons, or did last year when I was dieting down. And I think I was the only person to eat them, because I would see exactly the same stack as I'd left, you know, the week before. And that's the way it was at the sorbet. So I went to this other grocery store, and the same thing happened. And I just stood there flabbergasted. I think just in utter denial.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did you ask anybody at the store what was going on?
I really didn't know what to do. I didn't. I think I was just too traumatized. You know, I was really in shock.
Yeah.
So I just had to move along. And of course the rest of the day just sucked. and the DTs that night after training, when I didn't get my sorbet, I was like, I didn't know what to do with myself.
Well, on a serious note, so, you know, you're obviously using this for our quote unquote Slindo. What right. did you put in place of it then?
I spent that time just rocking in the corner.
So for real, you got less calories in because it wasn't around, huh?
I'm losing my gains with the Z because of this issue. Like this, yeah. Wow. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Maybe there's going to be an influx. I remain positive, you know, that I'll be able to, you know, this is the thing about being a bodybuilder. You have these obstacles, you know, that you learn to overcome. We talked about this in the last one. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you get tested. And I know if I can make it through this, I'll be a stronger person. So that's what I'm shooting for.
Wow. Well, we're all rooting for you. And if it gets really bad, you can come up here. And I will take you to Westbourne Market or any other number of stores that carry sorbet.
I may, you know, drive up there, you know, drink Mountain Dew for a straight 24-hour drive and
there you go.
Go right to the sorbet store.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, Jordan, I wanted to tell you, I as of this morning, I'm officially a member at the trainedbyjp.com website.
Ah, very cool. Very cool.
I just started going through the videos today. I haven't had enough time to really check it out yet, but man, you know, I had seen some of the stuff before. There's so much at the site, and I mean, $6.99 British pounds. That's like $10 a month. So I feel like that's money very well spent. It's super entertaining from what I've seen so far, and of course, more importantly, it's awesome information. So thanks for having me over there. I can't wait to check it out more.
Thank you for joining. I think we have over 150 videos on there.
So nice.
There's a lot of content. I mean, I don't think you could get through it all in a month, to be honest.
Where do you recommend I start? What would be the first place that you would suggest stopping?
I would just pick one of the subcategories and just start watching.
All right.
It all eventually flows into one kind of idea. There's like there's reoccurring themes through a lot of the videos. So yeah, I'd just pick and start anywhere really.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Cool. So how was training today? Assuming you just got back.
Yep, training was good. Thanks. I had a leg session. My like semi-injured left leg held out okay.
Yeah,
That was good. We have some custom-made attachments now, so I can make things heavier.
Yeah.
Oh, nice!
I can't get enough weight on the seated hammer strength plate-loaded leg press.
No kidding.
I can't get enough weight on the hamstring curl machine. I have to pin 2 20-kilo plates to it.
Wow.
And I can't get enough weight on the adductor machine. Pin like 110 kilos to that one. So we have 2 different lots of custom attachment to be able to extend how much weight can be fit on, which is cool. So I made the most of those today.
What are they, Jordan? I know of like several ways to do that. I'm sure what the guys
on the plate loading machines.
Yeah,
you would remove the kind of rubber stopper.
Yeah, put a post in there,
and then it has a pole that slides into the gap.
Yeah.
And then once the pole is in fully, there's then just a metal extension that's the same diameter as the current machine's part where you load. So it simply extend that arm to allow you to fit on like another 2 plates.
Do you remember that video? It was a long time ago. Of the guy, he was, I think, the first guy that Dante had doing dog crap training, went by Inhuman. Big guy, shaved head, always wore full sweats. And he was on a hammer strength incline press. It was this video that passed around, and he was doing, he had 8 plates on a side for like a set of 6 or something like that. And they were controlled reps. And yeah, he had done that, you know, because he had worked, I think he held normally 5 and he had added 3 to each side.
Yeah. Like I'm up to doing 7 plates on that machine.
Nice. Nice.
Jeez.
I could only fit 6 on the arms, and then the other plate had to go on the handles. But that really, really got annoying. So I'm looking forward to doing that next time with the plate in the right place where it's not getting in the way of my hands.
Hmm. You put bands on the handles too? That's what I usually do.
to be honest, I actually dislike banding a lot of the stuff. I find the way it alters the strength curve just pisses me off. I like feeling the load on a lot of different stuff, especially on pressing. I like feeling the load through the whole range of motion. I rarely band things. The only thing I band is a conventional leg press now, to be honest. Because the rest of the stuff, I just don't like how it feels.
Do you band it then, so that the concentric movement is? Do you put it like a traditional band or a reverse band on it? Then I assume you're making it harder. You're not deloading the weight ever on the leg press.
Either or.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter because if you deload it, you then just put more weight on.
Okay.
That just has the same effect as a positive band, really, because the band tension diminishes at the top, so then the overload comes from the weight at the top, and vice versa.
Gotcha.
With a positive band, if you positive or reverse band, you still get the overload in the exact same portion of the lift.
Yeah, I do like the band, partly because on chest pressing stuff, I have to be careful because I'll end up tweaking stuff, and I had a little pec tear not too long ago, so I need to go. I like that it removes some of the momentum from that. I don't like that it ends up overloading near the full extension, but I don't feel it that much the way I typically band. And it also saves plates. That's the reason why I band a lot of times. It's just like, because I'm training by myself 99% of the time, and I just don't want to. It just saves me a lot of time. Just add a couple bands. So yeah, I do. I don't do it necessarily to alter the strength curve as much as just to save plates. And I do like the feel of removing the momentum. Because sometimes you're not driving with the muscle. You get the weight moving at the beginning. And then, if I'll spend like on a hammer machine, a pendulum based free weight loaded machine, if you sort of explode out of the bottom, the weight will kind of carry through and the band prevents that from happening.
I guess it does, doesn't it?
That makes sense. That's what I like about this. It makes a lot of selectorized machines go feel more smooth. I've noticed this like almost universally is that if you band on there, it feels smoother. And then plus, like Jordan was saying, if you're adding plates to a selectorized stack, especially if they have the guard on there still, you can't add them. What's the other accoutrement they have there, Jordan, for adding weight?
It's a hook that goes over a weight stack. So
if you
add something that's got like a guard on it, as long as you can fit the hook in over the weight stack, it then comes down and has like a pole that comes out, and then you can just whack on as many plates as you want. I put a video on my Instagram of me doing the adductor machine using it. It's like loaded up with four 25 kilo plates and then a 10 kilo plate.
Yeah, the only thing about those sometimes is that if you get all that weight on one end of the stack and it's loaded at the top of the stack, it ends up creating some torque, which then creates friction.
The friction difference is pretty noticeable, actually.
Yeah. There's a thing, a guy that Dante connected with, and I have two of these things. It was pretty cool years ago, and I could probably find the guy, but it wouldn't be that hard to fashion. Basically, he just took what is the post you see on the hammer strength machines, and cut off about maybe an 8-inch, maybe a 10-inch section of that, so you can fit three plates on there, and then welded on a pin to that. So you just stick that pin into the stack where you just any place. Of course, you've already got the whole stack pinned with the regular pin. You stick that post in there, and then you've got a post that comes out, wherever you put it in the stack, and you can add plates on top. And that helps a little bit with that friction effect, because you can put the weights lower, so it doesn't pull the weight stack from the top and cause the friction.
Yeah.
And those are pretty cool. And you can do on pec deck, a lot of times where you've got the weight, you've got access to both sides of the weight stack, that there's a hole on either side, you can you know, pin a plate on either side, and then you avoid the friction because you've evenly loaded it. But yeah, it's fun to do that. It's like, okay, here we go. It's like kind of like an adventure in like abusing the machine. But then it's also kind of such a pain in the butt, you know, because it takes you, you know, 12 minutes just to set the thing up.
I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Jordan, I'm interested in the fact you're doing heavy, heavy adductor work. It's something I feel like a lot of people neglect, something that I realize that I can forget when I'm training legs at times. How important is your adductor work, the direct work that you're doing with that muscle?
I think massively. Like, I've done it for forever, because that was one of the things that I read on Intense Muscle when I was like 17, 18, where Dante was making posts saying that, like, seriously, if you want complete legs, you need to have good adductors. I have pretty big legs, but I don't have great quads, but I do have big adductors.
Hmm.
And that makes my legs look a lot bigger than probably other people that when I'm standing next to them. And if you tape measure mine are, they measure pretty big. But mostly, I think that's because of adductor thickness.
Wow.
And when you look at people that have had decent legs, Tom Platz, for example.
Yep.
A lot of that, like, craziness that is going on is because there is so much adductor there. So I've been obsessed with training for years. The only thing that pisses me off is when machines just don't go heavy. My favorite one is the hammer strength plate loaded one, because you can load up like 6 25-kilo plates on that, and if you've got that on there, that normally means I can only do like a 15 rep set, which is about perfect. I don't really like going under 12 to 15 reps on adductor work, because I think otherwise you're kind of just dabbling with injury risk a little bit, and if you just tweak your adductor, that can put you out for a couple of weeks. I think everyone should be training adductors. It's important.
Dante had said, and if you look, like, I can see it in my mind, there's these, sometimes they're in black and white, these pictures of Platz's legs at pretty much their best. And there's one from the front when he's kind of got his leg semi-crossed over. And if you look at the quad, I mean, obviously the quad's just amazing. If you can somehow take your mind and just look at the quadriceps, it's not like, it's obviously massively impressive, but it's not like overblown. Like, his legs look overall, and you can see, like, there's so much adductor meat. And literally the adductors meet like 4 inches above his knee. There's so much size there. And of course, when you have that adductor too, your legs look better from the side, because you're able to sweep your adductors and it pushes your hamstring out and gives you better hamstring hang.
Yeah.
So having better adductors looks great from the front, and it looks great for your hamstrings from the side and from the back, especially because the adductors, there's, you know, an anterior and a middle and a posterior portion. So the anterior is what you get really with the adductor machines, and you can vary that depending on how you position your legs, the amount of internal rotation you use in your hip joint, and then if you're doing lots of, you know, squatting and deep leg pressing and that kind of stuff, then you get the posterior adductors, which look awesome from the rear too, like on a, you know, a rear double by or what have you. But yeah, it's that and actually I think you were even there, Jordan, when Dave commented some point when I was there in his hotel room at the Arnold this year, and he was like really happy with how he looked, obviously, and he was commenting about his own adductors.
Yeah.
Because he's seen that, you know, they've come up. He's like, you don't see this on a lot of guys. He was really happy about that. He's got a unique shape to his adductor, and he's got a little bit of it. Like, there's a, you know, portion of his that stands out, and it helps make his legs look better. So that was one thing that came up.
I'm looking at Jordan's picture right now of his legs, and I can see it, you know, if I just kind of like cover up where the adductor is, I can see it. I mean, obviously that quad sweep is crazy. The definition is nuts, and that makes him look even more big. But just looking at how much I see it, I see how important the adductor is in making that overall thickness. And I hear what you're saying too, Scott, about that. It's almost like the illusion we create from the side, right? Or you're kind of mm-hmm. pressing one leg into the other to kind of flatten it out. Like if
go ahead.
I was going to say, if I'm sitting at my desk right now and my quads are pressed against the seat and I look down at them, they look amazing because they're all spread out, you know? But so, you're talking about the same thing from the side.
Yeah. I call it, I've always kind of called it, maybe I made this term up, but sweeping the hamstring. So when you turn to the side, you know, people will put like the front leg back. Yeah. And then you try to drag your rear knee into the backside of your front knee, or sort of your front knee into the backside of your rear knee. So, if your left side's facing, your left knee would go towards your right knee, and then that basically takes your right adductor and pushes your left adductor back, and that pushes your left hamstring back and down.
Yeah.
So when you when you sit down on that leg, the hamstrings being pushed forward or pushed backward and down, and it just hangs there. Hmm. And that gigantic difference if you do that the right way. And that comes just from having the sheer mass of the adductors there, pushing the hamstring in the right direction.
Do you guys feel like doing wider stance squats or plie squats, something like that, would be beneficial for somebody that's trying to bring that up too?
Like I personally don't do them. I find I don't really like, this is just me, so, but I'm sure other people have different ideas, but I generally like training my legs in the position that allows me to load the best. Like my general opinion is that if you want big legs, get really 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 strong and take your body weight up as high as you can until you get fat. And if you pick a stance that allows you to get really, really strong, and you put on a ton of body weight, you're going to get big legs.
Hmm.
Simple. And then you mm-hmm. diet back off and you repeat. And then you diet back off and you repeat. And I don't think some of those stances, especially with a low volume approach where you're only limited to the amount of sets that you can do before you start to overreach when the goal is progressive overload, I have never thought that any of those funky moves are worthy of me wasting a set. I just want to get in. I just call it like the power position where I put my feet.
Hmm.
I get in the power position and I just try to move as much weight as I can with decent form. And then I just take my body weight up. And that will bring about big legs in everyone. Like, unless you're obviously a really crappy responder, but then plie squats isn't going to fix that anyway.
Yeah, that's a soundbite right there, man. That last 2 minutes was pure gold.
Okay.
Anyone who's listening, rewind that, play it 3 or 4 times, ingrain that into your mind, because that's good stuff. And you know, and the thing too is, if you get really really strong, and assuming you're not, like, let's say you're squatting, you're not making it into some sort of a good morning, you're actually engaging the muscles that you're trying to target with particular exercise, you'll be training so hard and pushing so hard that you're going to be activating the adductors and the quads, you know, the medialis, the lateralis, the rectus femoris, like all the quad muscles will be going, everything's going to be going. And by the time you get to those last few reps, you've activated all the muscle mass that's available. So you're going to get, if you were measuring EMG, you might find that if, you know, you did a set of 10 reps, with a weight that you could do for 15 or 20, you're going to find, you know, on average over the course of those 10 relatively easy reps, that one particular leg, you know, one particular position is going to mean more lateralis activation than medialis. And that's true. That'll happen. But by the time you get to that last rep, and this is the thing you don't see tested because you're not doing muscle activation types of studies very often with advanced bodybuilders. I mean, I can only think of a couple instances I know when they've sort of done this sort of thing. By the time you get to the end of that crazy set, everything's going because you're giving everything you possibly can. Yeah. So you're going to get adductors as long as they're reasonably required for that particular movement, which, you know, like Jordan's saying, in that power position where you feel like you've got everything, everything involved with the movement, you're going to get that activation. It's going to happen. You just got to train really, really, really hard to do that. So, you know, otherwise you're sort of pussyfooting around trying to like change, change angles and all that kind of thing too much. It doesn't mean that there's not value there, because there most certainly is. But I think, you know, if you had to weigh that versus training really, really hard, effort is numero uno, at least in my book.
All right.
Yeah.
I feel like there was a time I used to put all the weight in my hips when I squatted. It seemed like I'd get some hamstring development, and that's what would feel sore too, would be hamstrings and glutes. And I felt like I wasn't getting much quad activation, but I think that for me, it was a matter of finding like what Jordan's calling his power stance. You know, I mean, I was strong that way, but I wasn't activating everything though. So I guess it was a problem, you know? And I think I've learned to work the quads into it now. And I've found that I'm now strongest in that position, because I feel like I'm using all the muscles, you know, as you're talking about.
Yeah, there will be a learning curve. I'm going to maybe sound like I'm contradicting myself here, but I squatted for years and years and years, and I got a gigantic butt, and it was great for my hamstrings, but it really didn't do as much for my quads.
Okay, yeah. So what did you do then? How did you fix that?
I squat on a Smith machine. For the most part, for heavy stuff, because you can finagle things a little bit.
Okay.
And actually, recently, Jordan, I've been doing just because I just wanted to kind of, you know, let the screws rattle around in my head a little bit. I've replaced a muscle round for thighs with a high rep squat set. And that is because of its novelty, and I think because what I've done over time with squatting on a Smith machine, in particular, is I've learned how to engage those muscles a little bit differently. And probably I'm going lighter too, but I'm training really hard. These sets are nerve wracking. Like, you're sweating before you start the set. Because it's like, this is going to, it's a widow maker basically.
So how many reps are you getting?
Last time I did 35 reps.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
And explain to us what a widowmaker is.
So people are gonna be like, you're not supposed to do this on fortitude training. You said this yourself, Scott. But it's an experiment. I mean, I spend probably half the time I'm doing fortitude training messing around with different ideas. So a widowmaker is as far as I know, that's Dante Trudell's terminology for a high rep, approximately 20 rep set, but you can do it with different rep ranges if you want to go higher. He said people do up to 50 reps before when he's done customized programs for them. But the widowmaker basically means that you're trying to kill yourself. If you were married and you're a guy and you did this set, you know, to death, then you would have created a widow, meaning your wife, because you're gone. That's it. And so a widow maker is a discontinuous set. The idea is, the way I explain it to people is, like, if someone watched this actually happened to me a few weeks ago. If someone watched this from afar in the gym, they would think that you're off your rocker, like that you're really kind of a bit crazy. There's something wrong with you.
Oh yeah.
You know, you really got some anger issues or something, because you pick a weight. Let's say your goal is somewhere around 20 reps, and you're trying to get as many reps as you possibly can without racking the weight, without putting the weight down.
Yeah.
So if you're doing a free bar back squat, you might end up taking a strategy where you get maybe 12, 13 reps, and then you take a few deep breaths and do another two or three, and take a few deep breaths and do another two. And then you might end up doing like singles with like 10 seconds in between them until basically, you know, you can't do another rep. So the strategy literally is to try to extend the set to do as many reps as possible, as if they're a gun to your head. So, and it ends up being a strategy. I mean, you can get better at these just by managing your fatigue. You know, some people, you know, they might end up getting more reps if they just bang through 15 reps really fast. Yeah. Whereas others might do 10 and then take some breaths and then do another 3 and take some breaths. And for me, the way at where I put it, like on a back squat, for instance, the place I put the bar on my shoulders ends up meaning I'm stooped forward a little bit. So I feel, and this is part of the reason why my glutes would grow so much, I think, from doing squats in general, is my glutes end up getting activated. And I get to the point where I'm like, I don't get any rest when I'm standing there with the bar, at least in terms of my glutes. So I can feel my glutes and low back are like, okay, I got about, you know, another 15 seconds before this is over. But I've gotten better at that. So that's the Widowmaker. You're basically trying to extend the set as long as you possibly can, get as many reps as you possibly can.
I love that stuff personally. Those are my favorite kind of sets in the gym.
John Meadows calls them a challenge set.
Yes.
Same sort of thing, you know. Where it's like, okay, like he just in his system, he's just kind of like, he has them, you know, set up if you buy his programs, but like you're doing it. Like when I've trained with John, it's just like, all right, we're doing this. Like, you're just like, let's just pick something that's just absolutely asinine. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, whatever, we're just going to go do this.
Yeah.
There's one with Antoine Vallant where this is actually in John's book that I co-wrote with him, The Brutality of Mountain Dog Training. We described this one this particular day, and there's video of it you can find where they just walked over. And I think, you know, Antoine was a really strong presser. And they said, okay, you know, I think it was 150 pound dumbbell flat presses. And he said, we're doing 30 reps. Whoa. And, you know, Antoine's like, what? What are you like? I can't fucking do that. I can't even close to that. But he's like, yes, you can. You will. Mind over matter, you know, make it happen. And you just go in there and you just go like there's a gun to your head and your family is above a pit of molten lava. And if you don't get 30 reps, they're getting dropped, you know,
yeah,
and you just go for it. So those are fun, man. That's like jumping out of an airplane.
You know, I've only ever heard the term Widowmaker in one other context, and that's in tree cutting. Have you guys heard that term?
No.
Uh-huh. It's a branch that it's been broken from the tree and now it's just hanging above the other branches. So it would be like a heavy branch, a branch that if it were to dislodge itself, if the wind blew, this branch is just suspended by some thin branches. If it were to fall and hit you, you know, you would die. I was told a long time ago that a guy pointed up at the sky at this branch, probably weighed, you know, 70 pounds. And he said, that's called a Widowmaker. And that was the first time I had heard that. I prefer the gym terminology because it resonates with me.
Yeah, I had one of those in my front yard. Not to get too far off topic, I had a tree that died. He had to cut it down, and I had a tree guy came out to do it, and he was sawing through the thing, and he was standing there, was leaning off to the side, and he's kind of standing up looking at it. And I'm like, hey. It's making some strange noise here. Why don't you just come on over here? I don't, it's not safe right there. And literally I said that he walked out and the thing fell like Dang. 4 seconds. It would have just squished him.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the, there's a whole tree. So the whole tree was a Widowmaker, I guess.
Yeah. Well, this stuff on light training was awesome. I really appreciate it, guys. This is kind of unplanned, but I think it was really good information. And I believe that everybody's going to be able to get something out of that. Scott, you kind of had a little bit of a, what's called, what, a public service announcement today, right?
Yeah, it was just, you know, trying to come up with material that I think could benefit people. And it's a really, for some people, this I think is probably a really obvious thing. And then for others, it's not at all. It may be a sort of a psychological phenomenon where folks are sort of looking for some kind of a magic bullet or an easy fix, which makes sense. We, you know, seeking out the path of least resistance is can be a good way to go about things, but it may not always be the best way. Hmm. So the idea that I just come across so often is relates to dietary adjustment. And this is, you know, what people to a large part hire coaches to do, probably more so than their training. They kind of set the training program, but the online coach, at least, is adjusting their diet. Of course, their supplements too. And just time and time again, people will mention either in passing as part of a question or as a direct question, they'll say, You know, I'm going into my off season and I'm thinking about setting up my calories at, you know, 4,000 or 5,000. What do you think is best?
Yeah.
And, you know, of course there's the whole context. Well, I don't know how big you are. You know, what that value means in terms of your body size. I mean, if you're 120 pounds, you know, that's might be a bit much. If you're 285, that might not be enough. But the idea is that people seem to have is that you can just sort of pick a number and that static caloric intake or static macronutrient composition will be what you just stay at to produce muscle mass gains, for instance, during your off season. And that it's not a dynamic process, which it sort of obviously is. And this, I almost sound like, geez, Scott, like you're stating the obvious here.
Yeah.
But it's not. I see this time and time again. So the main idea is that, you know, how many calories you would need to produce fat loss or produce muscle gain is a function of what's happening to your current body composition. You may need to change nothing if you're going in the right direction.
Sure.
And then secondarily, what you're currently eating. So if you're taking in 2,500 calories with certain macro composition and you're stable, and you want to create a weight gain, muscle mass gain, then you're going to go up from that value. You're not going to immediately jump, and this is the important part, you're not going to immediately jump to some value that's substantially above that because there's some magical number that's appropriate for you, even at your weight. And I'm sure we've talked about this. There's a couple studies. I wrote an article that's still up on Elite FTS about this. There's a guy named Claude Bouchard, who's a geneticist, Canadian geneticist. He's done some really cool stuff with twin studies, examining the genetic underpinnings of obesity and the impact of overfeeding, underfeeding. And in this pair of studies, they took twins, identical twins, same DNA, and fraternal twins, so mono and dizygotic twins. And the fraternal twins basically are genetically similar, but just as similar as a brother and sister would be, you know, who weren't born from the same womb. And in one study, they take them into a clinic, they completely sequestered them there, and established a caloric intake that was in equilibrium. Basically standardized diet, got them standardized there. And one of the studies, they said, okay, we're going to drop your calories by 500 per day, and we're going to also have you do 500 calories worth of exercise on a cycle ergometer. So they could quantify what was initially basically reduction of caloric input or an imbalance of 1,000 calories on day one. In the other set of studies, they did the opposite. I think it was 6 out of 7 days a week, and both of these studies ran about 3 months or so. The other study, they overfed them by 1,000 calories. And you saw dramatic changes or dramatic sort of variability in the amount of weight loss and fat loss in both studies. The identical twins showed almost the exact same change. The fraternal twins showed, you know, pretty close, but not dead on. It might have been like 7 kilos versus 8.5 kilos for a given twin pair. But when you looked across the pairs of twins, some gained fat really readily, you know, 10, 15 kilos, whereas others gained 4 or 5. There was like more than like a threefold range. And that's because of some metabolic adaptation. It's because of non-exercise activity thermogenesis, the extent to which people fiddle. The more you eat, the more some people tend to be active. It increases activity levels. So there's some genetic, there's obviously a genetic component here because you saw almost exact changes in the twins that were identical twins. But all those other factors, be it metabolic factors or behavioral factors and how much activity they did, was also dependent upon the person's genes. You know, twins, identical twins, will tend to have personalities that are somewhat similar, of course. So they're going to respond to this sort of situation in the same way as well. So that's the thing, is like an increment of X number of calories is going to be having a different effect on everybody. That's what a coach does. He looks at that, he sees what happened, and then he adjusts dynamically. So you can't just say, well, I'm going to just take 1,000 calories Because 1,000 calories might produce 1,000 calorie excess might produce 3 times the increase in body mass that it does in someone else.
Yeah.
Because of all these things that change when you introduce that dietary perturbation. So that's my public service message. So if someone says, you know, you should eat this amount and this amount, that's going to change every week. You know, you're going to have to adjust every single week depending on a host of variables, some of which you don't even know what's going on exactly, but you can see what's happened with the body composition and the weight and the body weight.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times newer people think that we're holding out on them. We're not giving them all the information that just give me the number of calories I need to eat in order to get in shape. Give me a diet plan. You know, tell me what I need to do. And the thing is that, yeah, you gotta look into all the factors, you know, and like you said, everybody's totally unique. Just to bring Jordan in on this one, Jordan, when you are working with somebody on their diet, and let's just talk more general about calories, you know, you've got their plan going and then you make their adjustments. Do you then count all their calories up again every week to say, okay, you were, you know, now you're getting 4,250 calories each day?
No.
No? Yeah.
I have no idea what any of my clients are on calorie-wise.
Yeah.
I don't care.
And why is that? Can you explain to us why that's not important?
Obviously, it is important but knowing the number. Well, let me rephrase.
Yeah.
What's important is the consistency of your caloric intake. What's not important is knowing what that number is.
Yes.
I have a video on this on my website that's called "Your Macros Versus Someone Else's Macros."
Nice.
It's just it pretty much just says everything that Scott just said. Where I just try to drum home that your macro intake in relation to someone else's is just totally irrelevant. And also your macro intake in relation to where you were maybe 2 years ago should also be irrelevant if you've trained hard enough. Because if you're training hard from year to year, you will be able to adjust your set point in terms of your caloric needs. And what I mean by that is that when you have more lean body mass, your general needs in terms of food will adjust, not necessarily because of the body mass aspect, but because of what you've done to achieve that body mass. And what I mean by that is over 2 years, you should have got better at training hard. And as that improves, your caloric needs will change.
Interesting.
Because the actual difference in terms of muscle mass and how that reflects on metabolism isn't huge, but it's what you do that plays the biggest impact on your caloric needs. So like Scott was talking about, what you do on a day-to-day basis, what you do for a job, what your need levels are, that's all what impacts on your caloric needs. But if that's all consistent, which generally it should be for most people get up, they go to work, they do pretty habitual things, then knowing your caloric number doesn't really matter. The only time that it might be beneficial is to know the macro breakdown of your meals, if you just need to just swap meals in and out. And that's pretty easy to work out if you've got a meal that's all uncooked weight, that's 200 grams of chicken, 100 grams of avocado, and 65 grams of basmati rice. That takes 10 seconds to work out that macro number. And then if you do need to switch it, then you just switch that meal out. But like on the whole, knowing what that total caloric intake is for your diet, I wouldn't ever get hung up on that number.
Yeah.
It just bears no relevance to anything tangible or important.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me.
There's only one thing I'll just toss in there. This is really, it's almost too obvious, but... And you'd see this. I mean, it'd be pretty clear. But if your calories are really, really low, you know, sometimes you'd like get used to looking at your food, and then you go and you figure out that someone's eating like 6 calories per pound, or something just obscene. You're like, okay, we've run up against way too few calories. And sometimes it takes like a number like that to like jar people's perspective. back into the right place. They can say, okay, we've got to have to eat you back up because we can't drop your calories anymore. You know, you're in a bad state metabolically here. But otherwise, I agree wholly with that would be pretty obvious. But sometimes, you know, when you're hurting and you're, you know, weeks out from a show, it's kind of hard to see the obvious in many cases.
Yeah.
Scott, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How long does it take to reestablish normal metabolic function post show?
Oh God, that's going to depend. It's going to depend so much on the person and what they were doing too. If someone was using thyroid,
sure.
And you know, and they want to come off of that, how prolonged their deficiency was, what's happened with their body fat too. If you're really, really lean, you know, then, you know, your body's going to want to put on fat, you know, pretty readily. I have, and so this is going to vary just a massive amount. Cause some people will end up with, you know, impaired thyroid after a period of time, and it can take them a while. So God, that's a really good question. And I think it's just so variable. I have found that, at least for me, it's almost worth my while after a show to like just intentionally try to get my body fat out from the like really crazy shredded, because I feel much better. Sure.
More from a perspective of them being able to perform in the gym.
Yeah. So most people rebound so hard, they get out of that spot, you know, right off the bat. I mean, yeah. And this is something that probably you have some good insight from how Corin took her off season this year, because she stayed really, really lean. So she was probably, I'm guessing, you know, teetering on that no man's land, that really low body fat where it could, of course, she's made of, you know, titanium and adamantium and who knows what else. So she can push so hard. But yeah, I think that kind of depends on the person. If you're like from a woman's perspective, it's pretty interesting. They've looked at the female athlete triad, which is kind of focus on amenorrhea.
Yeah.
That comes, you know, in athletes that intentionally keep their body weight low and their body fat low. And there's some interesting research that suggests that it's a lot of that dysregulation of the menstrual cycle is a function of the caloric intake or the caloric deficit that someone's in, as opposed to just body fat. So, yeah, I mean, there will be women, you know, natural competitors who, when they start eating again, they may be very, very lean and they're okay. Hmm. and then there's, you know, there are women that once they get, I know of a female competitor, for instance. I mean, and she was not a natural competitor, and she was a very high level competitor. And she would still struggle with having her period during the week of a show. Hmm. And I'm like, how can that be? Like, this doesn't make, and she wasn't like she had, you know, bunk stuff or what have you. It's like, how can this possibly be? So her menstrual cycle was just so robust that, you know, nothing slowed it down. It was happening no matter what she did. And then other people, you know, in terms of metabolic irregularities, you know, it could take quite a bit. And I think, you know, the other thing too, I mean, if we're just talking about menstrual cycles, it's a really fascinating area of study, and I don't know a ton about it, but obviously this is really tightly controlled to population of our species. So it doesn't make sense when there's a caloric deficit to have regular menstrual cycles, because you don't want to get pregnant when there's not enough food around to support the growth of a embryo and fetus and to have a baby. So it's a good time from an evolutionary standpoint to turn off menstrual cycling. And the same thing holds when it comes to stress. So, you know, if you're, you know, a woman who's under a tremendous amount of stress, and this would, you know, in tens of thousands of years gone by or even before that, that's probably not the best environment to be safely raising a child. So yeah, we'll hold off until the stress is low. So you have women, especially, you know, especially with, we talked about you know, today's social media and body image issues and what have you. So a woman who goes through this very typical situation where she diets down, she looks really, really good, maybe for the very, very first time, at least in her mind's eye. She's getting more attention from guys and what have you. She does her show. Maybe she was poorly coached. You know, this whole other topic comes into play. And then she's post-show, and she's adding her calories back in, and her body fat's starting to rise, and she doesn't like it very much. Yeah. And things are changing, and so she's stressed. So that stress in and of itself is going to have an impact on her hormonal status. So, like, that's just one aspect of this post-show period that could be highly variable, whereas someone else with a different psychological makeup, another woman, be like, hey, I like having a big round booty. Give me my butt back. I want this, you know, and she's fine. She's happy. You know, she feels great. She's eating normally. She eats more. And she really has, you know, nothing. She stays in decent shape and she's happy with that. Someone else who might have gotten into the, you know, this endeavor because they have a tendency for, you know, body image issues and eating disorders might, you know, be really stressed and, you know, go through dietary havoc. So that person could take forever to kind of re-regulate. Not forever, but, you know, months and months and months, not longer.
Yeah.
So that's a great question, though. I mean, I think that's definitely one that's going to be taken on a person-by-person basis.
For sure. I get asked quite frequently what I feel an optimal reverse dieting approach to be. And I'm not sure if you watched the reverse diet debate that was on YouTube.
No, I haven't.
Lane Norton, Eric Helms, Menno Henselman, and another chappie whose name forgets me, so apologies for that.
Trexler?
Possibly.
Maybe. Yeah,
he's okay. PhD as well.
Okay.
And it wasn't so much a debate, in honesty, because I think everyone was of the same agreement that it's just like you said there, initially putting on a bit of body weight just so then you have the ability to train hard and then slowly putting on weight thereafter. Just so body fat doesn't go back on so quick proportionally to the rate at which you could potentially gain muscle. And a lot of people ask me that, but I think the issue that it comes down to is just people's ability to adhere.
Yeah.
It's the downfall of it all. I think most people with the best intention will be like, I'm going to reverse diet, because they logically know that it's not great to get fat really quickly. Because yeah, there's just no benefit to that. But people obviously struggle to eat off plan. So, like, I think it's a good message to send to people to get themselves out of that hole a little bit and then just try to be as patient as possible.
Hmm. We've got a question that was, I can't remember if it was a recent one. Maybe there's been a couple of these, but yeah, that's a huge topic, and you're dead on in that it's, you know, people are finally kind of becoming aware that if you just, you know, blast your body weight up as fast as possible, you can sort of ruin your off season because you've got sort of nowhere to go. You went from, you know, 5% to 15%, and now you don't like how you look, and you don't want to put on any more body fat. So what do you got to do? I got to diet back down again. Yeah. And yeah, your body's going to put on fat much more easily than it'll put on muscle. Mm-hmm. So that finding that balancing point where you're gaining muscle mass at a decent rate, but then you've got a quote unquote caloric excess, enough calories to drive that process, is the tricky one. I'll have to look for that debate. That's interesting. There's a study from 2013. I'm looking at the names here, with a natural bodybuilder. Rosso is the first name. Jeremy Alenicki was on there. Jeff Stout is another person, and they followed someone for a competitor. I think it may have been the first author over a year's period of time. And he was a natural pro. I'd have to go and look at the study again to know for sure, but they sort of followed him, and he basically, you know, lost his the body fat and held on muscle mass pretty well. And when he came back out, he ended up pretty much exactly in the same in the same spot that he was beforehand. He'd been competing for a while, and he didn't have a rebound where he gained new muscle mass and was heavier at a lower body or a same or lower body fat percentage that people are looking for, that magical rebound. And that's the big question, is that even possible? And of course, that I think that entirely depends upon how big a person is, how close they are to what, you know, you could consider their quote unquote genetic limit, and how much muscle can they possibly gain, you know, with every factor in its correct place. If someone's, you know, 5'9" and, you know, they competed 160 pounds, they probably got some potential to be a heavier competitor. So post show, if they take their time and put on muscle mass, slowly and don't gain body fat, they could end up 3 months later, it's basically the same time point after their show compared to when they started their diet, in a better place body composition wise. But that's because they have room to improve. The question about the rebound, the way I'm sort of seeing it is there something magical there? Meaning, is that period of time after the show one that will allow you to grow in a way that you couldn't otherwise? And it's kind of a big question. You know, could you make those same gains, you know, just by growing as you naturally would over the course of years, of many years? It brings up that old sort of thought experiment where you have the two twins. I think, Scott, you know, we may have talked about this one before, Scott, maybe one of our questions. Where you take two twins, and Dante used to bring this one up too. You take them, and one guy, you know, stays, he competes every year, diets down, you know, comes back, diets down, comes back, and his identical twin just spends the first 2 years just getting as large as humanly possible. And then he spends a year slowly chipping away at the body fat. At the end of those 3 years, who's bigger? Who's got the better physique? And I think that would, you know, that could depend on how much that first guy limits his body fat and thus limits his muscle mass gains. But that's always the question. I would love to see, it would be really interesting to see, because there's a couple instances of this. Tad Inouye,
Tad
moniker?
The diet coach.
Tad the diet coach, yeah. Simple enough to remember that. He's got a twin. He's got an identical twin. And who doesn't compete, as far as I know.
I don't think he does. Yeah, he's just a normal guy.
Quote unquote normal guy. I've seen pictures of him. He obviously looks like Tad, but he looks like he's, you know, active. He's athletic. But it would be interesting to see if you took him, you know, at this age, and Tad may be retired now because he's a master's level guy like me. But it'd be interesting to see if you could instill a fire in his twin and give him 5 years, you know, how would he look? You know, could he, with fresh joints and with, you know, a basically newbie bodybuilding training age, could he grow into would he be better than Tad? Or would all those years of previous training have give Tad an advantage? You know, or would the wear and tear have, you know, impacted Tad such that, you know, he's not as good now as he would have been, you know, had he, you know, waited to train and start training until he was his late 30s or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, a lot of concepts there, but this is a super fascinating topic because people's experiences and their perspective and their opinions are so varied on this one.
Well, what do you guys say we take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, knock out a few questions?
Cool.
All right, we'll be right back.
Muscle Minds is made possible in part by Jordan Peters. If you've enjoyed listening to Jordan today, check out his website, trainedbyjp.com. The site offers over 50 hours of video content covering everything from the most basic approach to training and nutrition for beginners, all the way through advanced anabolic and insulin strategies for seasoned competitors. You can follow Jordan and Corin's blog as they prep for their next shows and have questions answered daily on their forum section. So check out trainedbyjp.com. If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at his website, fortitudetraining.net. Those who purchase Scott's book or any of his coaching products receive a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. So check out fortitudetraining.net.
All right, guys, and we are back. First question on the docket today. I have a question for the Scots. What vitamins, if any, do you recommend to get in injectable form? In this form, are they considered prescription, or can anyone get a hold of these? What are your thoughts here, Scott? I personally, you know, the only I know you've got some stuff to say, Scott, and I'm not sure where you're at with injectable vitamins, Jordan. The one thing I will say is I was tested to have low B12, and I did try the injectable B12 for a while. From what I understand, our ability to process it goes down orally. And that's the reason that in that case, an injectable can be beneficial. I think, though, that that's only going to be beneficial for somebody that has a deficiency. From what I understand, if you're already kind of like, quote unquote, topped off, that for a normal person that already has good B12 levels, it's not going to have a drug-like effect. So, yes, you know, if you had a deficiency, then increasing B12 might improve energy, possibly increase appetite, stuff like that. But if you're already good, you're not going to get any effect from, you know, injecting B12. And further, from what I understand, 1,000 micrograms of injectable B12 is supposed to be about pretty similar to 5,000 taken under your tongue, not subcutaneously. What's the sublingually? So you can get around having to inject B12 if you need it just by using a sublingual version. But that's all I'm going to throw in there. What do you guys think?
I hate injecting things. When I was doing, I think I said this on one of the radio shows before, that when I was doing PGF, each one of those shots was like three mini shots into each side. So it was six injections on each time you use it. Ugh. I know it's only an insulin needle, but you are still putting a needle into you six separate occasions. And then that was repeated three times a day. So that's 18 injections just from that. And then if I'm doing growth hormone that day as well, that's a further three injections. So we're up to 21. And then if it was insulin day as well, that's a further two, so that could be 23. And then if that was my gear shot on top, that's 24 times I've injected myself that day. So am I then going to inject a vitamin? No, I'm not. So people keep asking me, like, do I do Synthol? And I have done, and I wouldn't mind doing it again, but I just cannot be bothered to do the injection. because it just breaks me. So if I can just take one already, that's fine by me.
Did you always feel that way, Jordan? Or has it been like just a matter of burnout from being involved in bodybuilding for some time now?
I don't even necessarily, I'd say I'm burnt out, because I'm still prepared to do 24 injections.
Sure.
So I think that I'm still pretty fucking hardcore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No question.
But if it's not melting fat off, and if it's not growth hormone or insulin or anabolics, this is such a meathead thing to say, but I just don't care to inject it. So that's just the truth.
Fair enough.
You know, a lot of people from B12, they claim they get an appetite increase.
Yeah.
And you see that, you know, quite a bit. Vegetarians will most typically. And that's why they go and do that. And that's, you know, the doctors, you don't got to do it daily. Like a B12 injection will last you for quite a while. And they do those around. I mean, I see like health fairs all the time.
Yeah.
Doctors will do that. And it does, people feel better. You know, there's all sorts of malabsorption issues where people, you know, they're not optimal in terms of their B12. So an injection kind of, you know, it's just kind of a quick and dirty way to get around that. It brings your levels up pretty quick. So, But the injectable vitamins thing is kind of a, I do believe it requires a prescription, although you can't, you can find B12 online. Yeah. You can get it, you know, but an actual to administer it, you know, technically you'd have to be a licensed medical provider. And back in Arizona where, they've got a practice act for naturopaths, there are a lot of people that did that. And there are some places down here who do IV vitamins as well. And people, you know, I hear lots of good things about it. A lot of anecdotal evidence, but I haven't seen much really. I've looked this up a few times and, you know, maybe some of it's just placebo. I mean, the thing about placebos in general is the more rigmarole that goes into them, the more likely you are to create an expectancy effect. So, you know, if like you go to somebody, you know, in the gym, like let's say you're a dealer of some sort, you go to someone in the gym and you're like, hey, come on over here. Actually, come back here behind the building. And, you know, I want to give you this. And he reaches into his bag, you know, and he unwraps this thing and he shows you this bottle that's got, you know, special wrapping on it. And the pills are like purple and blue and yellow, you know, it looks, and it's, you know, it has all this, you know, bell and whistle type of, glitziness to it.
Yeah.
Then you're going to be like, oh, this is the stuff, right? This is it.
It's going to get huge.
This is going to get huge. So like the method of administration is gigantic. It's like,
yeah,
you're going to put an IV in me and this is going right into your blood. It's a direct administration. It's going right to you. So that's going to impact you. You can definitely make that happen. I've talked before about my favorite placebo study where they told athletes they're getting D-ball.
Yeah.
And part of the deal there was they took them to the health center at University of Massachusetts and they ran them through like a mini clinic, helping them understand what the side effects of anabolic steroids would be and, you know, what to affect. And they took blood, did blood work and the whole thing. They built this up.
Yeah.
So an IV administration is going to be a great way to produce a placebo effect. But a placebo effect is an effect, you know, it works. So people use, it's called Myers cocktail. So it's kind of a vitamin C and magnesium and calcium and B vitamins, that kind of thing. And that's the one you typically get. A lot of people are doing injectable antioxidants too. Like for instance, glutathione is one you get, and glutathione is like basically you take it orally, you don't increase blood levels of glutathione. People use N-acetylcysteine for that typically, but so you can get, you know, an improvement in your glutathione status by bypassing the gastrointestinal tract and just doing an injection. So, you know, that's why people would do those things, and you notice an effect. But some of that could be placebo too.
You know what else? The price on that stuff is expensive. And that's probably part of the placebo as well. If I'm spending, you know, X amount of dollars on this glutathione, it must be doing something.
Well, without a doubt, like all of that goes into it. You know, the more you can like dress it up, you know, the better it's really almost going to work. If you really dress it up and you just got to make someone believe it's going to work, and it probably will. Like it's going to, if they believe it, it'll happen. So, but the main thing with, you know, back to kind of the nuts and bolts of this question is like, look to see, like you, exactly like you said, Scott, are you deficient? Are you lacking in the vitamins? And you know, if so, and I'm all for like trying stuff out. Like if you find out that you're a little deficient, or, you know, maybe you got a good deal and you got some spare change and you want to go, you know, go to someone who'll give you an IV infusion. A Myers cocktail or what have you, then give it a shot, you know, check it out. I don't think, you know, unless the guy's like literally in a back alley and, you know, he to sterilize the needle, he licks it, you know, you're probably going to be safe getting this done. You know, people with latex allergies or whatever might have to watch out, but otherwise I think it's a relatively safe thing. It's just whether there's a difference between effective and efficacy. So if something's effective, that means it works. And if it's efficacious, that means it works according to the principles around which it's supposed to work. So it may be effective and not necessarily efficacious, but effective works, you know, just as well for most people. They don't care why it works. They just care that it does.
Okay. I'll go to Jordan first on this next question. He says, hey guys, I was wondering, and this is something we've kind of touched on as far as the nutrition portion goes. I was wondering how you would advise my best approach for post-comp diet and training period. My plan is to drop all compounds except for keep my test at a cruise dose of 200 milligrams each week and possibly leave in T3 at 25 to 50 micrograms to offset overeating that may occur, although I am confident in my ability to not go overboard. Should I use the 3 to 4 week period more efficiently by lowering my pre-contest doses and using TrenAce and Masteron to aid in utilizing the additional calories that he'll be taking in after the contest? He says he'll also be dropping all oral steroids after the show day. There's no question about that. He says, currently have prepped pretty much on a DC training split, but have upped my volume coming into 3 weeks out now. He'll probably be keeping in 60 to 90 minutes of cardio per week after the contest, and it'll all be a slow, steady state. He said that at this stage, HIIT cardio is beating him up, so he'll probably just leave that out. Any recommendations? What are your thoughts here, Jordan?
Okay, so we mentioned the diet aspect already.
Yeah.
That dig yourself out of that hole and then be patient. I think there isn't a massive need to keep cardio in. Like, it just depends how tired you are. And if you're pretty tired, I wouldn't be wasting my energy reserves and my potential motivation to do something on cardio. But it also depends how low his calories have gone and how much of a caloric deficit he's creating by doing that cardio. So this is obviously all relative.
It might be just as an interjection here. He says he's doing 60 to 90 minutes of cardio per week.
Yeah.
So that's not a whole lot, really.
No.
10 minutes a day.
So you could either keep that in or drop it. It's probably not going to make a difference either way.
Yeah.
Like, realistically. So that's your call. It sounds like he's probably just doing 3 by 20-30 minute sessions a week.
Yeah.
Just barely anything. If you were to drop it, you could then just be slightly more proactive across the day with your NEAT levels and just be a little bit more active doing things, which also would generally happens when you re-add calories anyway. Because most people's NEAT levels will drop at that point of a caloric deficit. So that's a fairly easy fix. In regards to drugs, I like what he said, to be honest. Like, dropping the orals is generally a good idea. They don't need to be there now, so just alleviate that stress on your body. Keeping in tren and mass, provided that you haven't gone crazy with the doses and you haven't trashed your body during your prep. Keeping them with the doses that you ran during your prep is adequate for like a potential rebound phase. And then maybe backing off the volume that you added in your training for the final phase. I personally don't add volume into that final phase. It's a tool that you can use if you're like running out of options, but it doesn't sound like you are if that's all the cardio you're doing a week. So I would be mindful of your recovery capabilities going into the final phase by adding volume. I don't think it's a necessity, personally. So I would just kind of assess the impact that's having on your physique. But I think it sounds like this guy's got a pretty good handle on what he's going to do. So now he just needs to just get it done and then just assess and decide what bits he did or didn't like for next time.
How about you, Scott? Do you have anything you would add to that or anything you might do a little differently?
Yeah, I like what Jordan said. he's asking about the 3 to 4 week period. And my only thought there is that, you know, sometimes after a show, sometimes people are just, they're wiped out. They might need like a week to just do, you know, little to nothing. And it sounds like he's got his diet under control. And sometimes you can go longer than 3 weeks. You might go 6 weeks. So I wouldn't necessarily set that in stone. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe he has a vacation plan or something like that. And then to add to what Jordan said, as far as the meat, this would be a good time. I've mentioned this before and on other podcast interviews I've done. Is like a lot of times after shows, you know, we've sacrificed our relationships in various ways, in other aspects of our lives. So this would be, you know, instead of that cardio, maybe, you know, take his significant other or a family member or, you know, some aspect of his life and reintroduce that with something that's active and fun. So it'll keep his mind off of like thinking, you know, I can eat as much as I want now because there's no show, but I have to hold my health back. And instead he can say, you know, this is going to be fun. We're going to go to the amusement park today, you know, or we're going to go down to the beach and, you know, throw Frisbee around or whatever it is, you know, that he likes to do. So I would suggest staying active and sort of regaining balance in his life afterwards too. I like the rest of what he said, you know, kind of wing it a little bit and, take care of himself. He might also, you know, get some blood work done, see where he's at there, make sure everything's, you know, in the right spot. But I totally agree about not the upping the volume thing coming into the 3 weeks out. I wouldn't do that at all. Unless, like Jordan said, he's like totally in a bad spot, but that's, you know, that would be probably one of the last things I'd want to do.
Yeah, for sure. Same. Okay. If you're already walking, like, I walk that line in off season in terms of recovery. So if I was to add more, this is the thing as well. In a final phase of prep, mentally you can do it because you can pretty much do anything in those final weeks.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean it's a good idea to do it.
Yeah, totally.
So I'm glad that hopefully that he'll listen to that and maybe readjust his volume back down.
All right. Thoughts from the guys on how to best approach a deload week in terms of training, if at all, nutrition, AIs, and length of time one should deload depending on the previous factors. Are there any advisable recovery strategies to maximize the deload time?
I heard that during the workout that eating cake's really good.
I like that.
That sounds good, actually. I like that too.
You just need to up your calories a little bit just to help.
What kind of cake? What people want to know, what specific kind of cake?
Well, if I'm ever asked what cake, generally the answer is cheesecake.
Oh, God, okay. Yeah,
right.
it's the most calorie dense. So
right. You go into the gym and you put down your cheesecake right next to the squat rack and you say, "Welcome to Cheesecake Muscle Factory, baby. Here we go."
I've seen a dude eating hard-boiled eggs during a training session before.
Oh, wow.
And he was squatting too, and he was a pretty good squatter, which was really weird. Like, technically, he was superb. Like, I think he was a weightlifter.
Uh huh.
He was sitting down and between sets, just snacking on the hard-boiled eggs.
Were they pre-peeled, or was he peeling them there, right? Like making a pile of shells as he.
They were pre-peeled. He was ready to go. He knew what they were for.
Right. There was a guy long, long time ago, when I was at University of Texas at Austin, there was a guy, I wish I could remember his name, he was a bodybuilder there. He's working on his PhD. And he used to eat like 30 eggs a day.
Wow.
Hard-boiled eggs. Yeah. And he had read something, you know, he told me the reason why. Oh, real super nice guy. I went and watched him compete. Blanking on his name. Really big dude. And he had read something, you know, some rat study that showed some advantage of egg protein, egg white protein. And he had this like gigantic Ziploc baggie full of, you know, of hard-boiled eggs. And I'd had conversations with him, but I'd watched him eat, like, just put a dozen of those things down. And they're just slimy and nasty by the end of the day. You know, I don't even know if he kept them refrigerated. They were just, you know, sealed in there. I'm like, oh. And he said the only thing he's bad about is the gas.
Yeah.
He had horrible gas from all that.
I did 24 of them a day for a couple of years, actually. It was just, I just felt like that's what I needed to do, you know, and I watched the Ronnie Coleman videos. I saw how many eggs he ate, and I felt like that's I needed to get my proteins up. So, and
was the marriage counseling that forced you to cease and desist?
Yeah, I took him to work, and we worked in a basement at the time, which was a kind of an enclosed area. So
you asshole.
Even if the gas didn't get to me, just the fumes of the eggs, I'm sure, just everybody probably hated me. At least it wasn't fish. Fish was like the next meal. I'd get like 2 cans of tuna fish out. And,
oh, my God.
It's all awesome. True. It's all true.
That's awesome. I'm sure you just were hated. People were talking behind your back constantly. Here comes Scott with his eggs and fish.
They liked me because I explained to them my goals and I was passionate about what I was doing. And, you know, I was new to the sport, so I wanted to tell people about it and stuff. And they got it and they were inspired. But, they probably didn't enjoy it.
Oh, that's classic.
So to answer it properly, you can either take the week off totally or you can decrease your training volume a little bit and stay away from failure. I think that the way that Scott uses deloading in Fortitude is probably the best approach I've ever seen to it. And he coins that as an intensive cruise. So him explaining that would probably be better than me. But the numerous times I've implemented that strategy, I thought that in comparison to a week's total rest, I enjoyed it more. That was just me.
Yeah, so that was sort of my thought. Like so with dog crap training, which we just talked about, the previous guy was doing, I guess, a DC inspired split. But the thing I noticed, and this isn't meant to be sort of a criticism on DC training, but the thing I noticed when I was doing a lot of DC training, when Dante was sending me clients, is that people would finish a blast where they were really pushing their weights, progressive overload, and they would take time off and. A lot of them would just like take, some of them would take up to 2 weeks off. Wow. They would just kind of completely auto-regulate and they would do nothing. And some guys would come back stronger and a lot of guys would come back, you know, having taken a step back. Hmm. So they would take like half of their next blast getting back to previous strength levels. And that was, of course, really frustrating, you know. So I looked at, when I developed Fortitude training, I really looked into the literature and I, you know, thought about what I'd seen too with those clients as well. And I knew about this from having been a swimmer, in high school and as a kid. And swimmers are known for basically doing much more than is needed. They do a massive amount of training volume, like 3-4 hours in the pool a day and then land dry work. Like, yeah, they really go for it. But they taper. They know to taper before a meet. And that was always a lot of fun. I always, you know, used to doing 2 hours in the pool and then like, you know, 2 days, 3 days before the meet, you'd like go in and like do nothing. You know, you'd swim for like 10 minutes and then we'd mess around and we'd play volleyball. We'd play like, you know, pool volleyball. And so that taper is used really, really well in lots of sports where you basically maintain the intensity of training, so you still train hard, but you reduce the volume. And what I did with Fortitude training, I kind of played around with this a little bit, is set it up such that you look at how long you've just pushed for, which means if you just were pushing hard for, let's say, you know, 6 weeks, you're probably going to need a little bit longer of a deload to reset and come back from that. Whereas if you only push for like three weeks, but you still think you need to deload, which can happen with Fortitude training, you wouldn't need as long to come back. So the deload duration would depend on how long the previous progressive overload or quote-unquote blast would have lasted. And the way I set it up with Fortitude training, because there's different volume tiers, you would just drop down a volume tier but you still train hard. You end up doing just the muscle round days, which introduces some variety, makes the training fun. You can try out new exercises, which was a great thing with DC training. You'd have people go in if you wanted to. This is sort of Dante's suggestion. And if you wanted to train during that period, you'd try out new exercises. If you knew, you know, I've already topped out on this particular, you know, leverage squat or what have you, you know, I'm going to try Zercher squats, you know, give those a shot and see how I like them.
Yeah.
So that's what I did with the intensive cruise, and it makes it fun. It's not quite the same as what is traditionally called active recovery, which a lot of athletes who do periodization will do, where they, you know, they go and they do something that's metabolically demanding, but it's not really sport specific training. But it does make the training that you do during the kind of a deload fun, because you're picking new exercises. You're just not doing a ton of volume. So you're literally recovering. And then just for the sake of having a life too, people like to plan their deloads around vacation time or time off. I always set it up such the last few days of a deload were free of training altogether. And that would really get people's motivation going. The thing that I think it's so common with bodybuilders who have a go, go, go mentality is that when you step away from the gym, you can't wait to get back in there, and you'll go back just because of habit before you're like really itching to go.
Sure.
And when you're like basically have waited as long as you can, and you're like, I just can't wait to get back in there and go after it. Like literally, you know, another day and you'd be, you know, tearing down the walls, then you're ready to roll. Then you're going to be highly motivated. You're going to do really well. And you probably recovered. That's the hardest thing. There's actually, you know, data. They've done surveys with athletes, who have overtrained, and they can't keep themselves out of the gym. So they just perpetuate it, or out of the, you know, off the road, if they're runners or cyclists or what have you, they can't step away. And so you have to fight that during a deload. So all those details are outlined in the book, but the main thing is drop your volume down, keep your intensity high, and then auto-regulate to some degree to make sure that you're completely recovered, so that you can get an overreaching effect. If you pushed, you step back like that and do a taper properly, you'll come back stronger when you go back to your next blast. And that's what I intended with fortitude training, and that's what that happens a large majority of the time, which I'm super psyched about. It's really pretty cool to hear people say that they're surprised when they go in the gym because they're just crazy strong.
Right on.
So, yeah.
I've got one more question. Actually, when I say one more, we've got about four more pages worth of questions, but we'll get to one more, and we'll just try to squeeze this one in quickly. He says, I have a question about injectable L-carnitine. After reading the article on John Meadow's site, it sounds like it needs time to build up in your system to get the most benefits. He says, I don't use insulin with it, but I do take it pre-workout, and I drink my branched dextrins with it to make sure that insulin is active. I definitely can tell the difference immediately when I start taking this because I'm drenched after the gym. Does this need to be taken consistently to have a loading period for it to be optimal? He says, I can tell it's working, but he just wants to figure out what's the optimal way to take it.
I know that the oral version has limited bioavailability. So to achieve levels of carnitine to bring about any kind of benefit, you would need to be on that for a long time. I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it would be maybe 5 months or something like that. Wow. It would take to fully load. But that's the oral version. There is a loading component, I believe, still with the injectable, but it happens really quickly. But that being said, I don't think you need to at any period take a higher amount. I think that you can just go in with a standard dose and then maintain that the whole way through the period in which you're in a caloric deficit, because there really is no benefits, I don't feel, to using it whilst you're in a surplus. I think it's just another annoying thing to inject. if you're in a deficit, it is a useful tool to use. So, and I use it when I prep. But I don't think that there's a need to load per se at the beginning, because that will occur quite quickly, and then you can just stay on a sustained amount throughout the whole diet. Scott or Brad answer the exact technicalities that I said.
well, you know, the IV stuff has been done by a guy over there in the UK. It's Paul Greenhalgh's lab. I think, Jordan, we talked about this at least once, probably several times. But so they've demonstrated that when they, you know, produce, I believe it was physiological range hyperinsulinemia. So they increase insulin levels to the extent you typically see with food, the meal. That helps with the loading. Contractions, muscle contractions help with the loading. So L-carnitine acts like creatine, as a matter of fact. Both of those are found in meat too, in that it's loading into the muscle cells is dependent upon, or is influenced by, contractions and insulin, both. So as far as that, before I go on, as far as that comment about the sweating and being drenched in the gym, I don't know that I've heard someone say that before. Maybe there's some, that could be like the solvents in the L-carnitine, you know. Maybe that's what's causing him to sweat out some toxins. But yeah, the effect's going to be on fat loss, not sweating necessarily, but at least not in a way that I know of. What's his basic question? He's one, to optimize the way to take it. You can. It was a matter of like 3 months. The oral version will load, but they just hadn't done the studies. So the way we want to do it is just basically what he's doing it. If you want to take it when you've got some muscle contractions that are overlapping with the elevation in blood carnitine levels, and you want to do it when you've got insulin elevation, which he's doing with the his carb source. So he's doing it the right way. So as to what is optimal as far as injection goes versus IV, that's a tough one. You can kind of I don't either that I know that I've even seen the pharmacokinetics on an injectable L-carnitine. It may be out there, maybe I'm forgetting about it, but you know, like how, if you were to inject this IM, how long the elevation is, how elevated you get, and that sort of thing. So there's some kind of a, you know, shooting in the dark going on here as far as, you know, how to sort of tinker with things optimally. But it doesn't take a whole lot of insulin exogenously if someone were to do that to match what they used in the studies from Greenhalgh's lab. So you can get that with carbs. Your insulin levels will be lower during exercise because that's what exercise does in part. There's a reason for that I could go into, but it's kind of off topic. But you're doing it right. I think he's got the two things set in place, and that's to make it happen pretty well. Optimal is kind of a different question, but he's on the right track, I think.
All right. Well, great, guys. I appreciate you coming on again and sharing everything with us, because this is, you know, I say it every time, this is great. We've gone just a little bit long here. I am sure that everybody will appreciate that, too. They want the shows to be endless. So if we did like a 4-hour show, they'd be thrilled with that. Mm. All right. Any good plans for the day?
I have another deadline at the end of the week. So I need to get that done. I had my biggest one last, not the biggest, but quite a hard one last week. But thankfully I had, again, Dr. Scott to kind of keep a loose eye over what I was doing, which was really, really beneficial. It was for my research proposal for my thesis.
Nice.
So, yeah, and I was really happy with how it went. So, this week, I can't even remember what the deadline I have for this week is. I can only focus on one piece of work at a time.
Mm,
yeah. So I need to start that tonight. I need to look up which one it is. But that's about me for the evening. Yeah.
Nice. How about you, Scott?
First, Jordan, do you want to put kind of a call out for people who might be interested in participating?
I've filled all the spaces for it
already. Oh, all right. Okay. Yeah. So you don't need any backups. You're good to go.
Oh, man.
I've got tons. Like, I literally had 30 people message to say that they would do it.
That's so awesome.
I can hand pick from that group, which is really cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go through and just pick the people that I think are going to just adhere the most.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Right on. Yeah, you might check with your advisor too, because you're bypassing the randomization procedure, you know.
Okay.
Because you got all these people come in, and then you want to have some entry requirements. It seems like they all matched it. Like, I think you wanted like 6 years of training, something like that.
6 years of training and 2 years of tracking macros.
Yeah. So if of those 30 people, they all matched your entry requirements, then that sort of makes sense. But you want to just make sure no one says, well, you really didn't randomize this because you had you selected them, you know, and that's, you can have experimenter effects when you're doing that to a certain degree. So
sure, okay.
That can cause a problem. Well, yeah.
Technically, I still don't actually have an advisor.
So. Oh, shit. Okay. Yeah,
The physiology department there doesn't have enough members of staff to cover all of the students.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for sure. I know. So going into that last research proposal, all the other students had advisors. So they were doing back and forth with their advisor. Some of the students were actually given a title by the advisor.
Oh, wow.
And then there was me. Thank God I had you.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
Well, let me know, like we talked about, if I can like be like the backup second and actually the guy who helps the most, I'd be happy to.
Well, when they actually get back to me about who is going to be my advisor, then I'm going to ask. So yeah. I'll see what they say.
You ask too many questions, you're a pain in the ass. No one wants to deal with you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, serious.
Yeah.
How about you, Scott? What do you have going on today?
Just time to train, baby.
Nice. And what's what's today's workout?
I think I'm going to give that squat thing another run for its money.
Nice.
Yeah.
Shoot a video for us.
I'll try to do. This is the one where I think I mentioned. We were just talking about it. It's sometimes hard to get the right squat rack because people kind of like, they hog the power racks in there. So hopefully I'll get in a good spot where I can mount my camera in the right angle, that kind of thing. But yeah, I'll get one of those.
All right. Cool. Well, guys, for Muscle Minds, I'm Scott McNally with Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson, and we are out of here.
Cheers, guys.
Adios.
Voices Radio Network.